A ratchet is a tool, like a socket wrench, that works in one direction, one step at a time. Our next guest says ratcheting is an apt description for the advances humans have made in feeding ourselves since the days of the hunter-gatherers. Unfortunately, every time we ratchet up food production, some crisis comes along to threaten those gains. Ruth DeFries, an environmental scientist, calls that threat a hatchet. So far, whenever the hatchet falls, humans have responded by pivoting, developing new technologies and strategies so we not only survive, but thrive. Ruth DeFries, who got her start in research in Maryland, says the question is whether humans can keep it all going. She's hopeful and tells us why. Next on Midday, after the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Rodericks here, thanking you again for joining us. Here's the good news from our next guest. After 14 millennia of struggling to fend off starvation, humans now produce enough food every day to provide 2,700 calories for every man, woman, and child on Earth. 2,700 calories. So we did a little checking. That's the equivalent of two Burger King Texas Double Whoppers, washed down with a McDonald's chocolate chip frap, or frappe. Of course, getting to this point hasn't been a piece of cake. Environmental scientist Ruth DeFries, who studies the complex interaction between food production and human progress, says our ability to feed ourselves, so far, flies in the face of dismal 19th century Industrial Revolution era predictions that population would outstrip food production and cause mass starvation. Since the hunter-gatherers first learned to plant crops, she argues, technology has repeatedly ratcheted up the food supply and enabled the population to grow. But this growth inevitably produces unforeseen problems and even disasters. For example, Europeans imported the potato from America in the 1500s. It became an efficient source of nourishment that allowed the population to grow. But Irish peasants became so dependent on the potato that a 19th century blight caused a famine that killed 1 million people and forced half again that many to leave Ireland for good. When these threats occur, Ruth DeFries says, humans typically pivot to new technologies, develop new crop strains, pesticides, fertilizers, strategies that enable them to ratchet up food production once again. But calories alone don't tell the tale. A critical problem, she notes, is that food isn't evenly distributed. Government, politics, infrastructure, war, corruption, and other big forces have combined to create this contradiction. Here you go. 30% of the world's people don't get enough to eat. 40% of us eat too much. Obesity is now one of America's most pressing medical problems, among the poor especially. Even if we can solve those problems, Ruth DeFries asks, in an age of global warming, greenhouse gases, and other threats, can humans keep up this game and provide enough food when the Earth's population climbs from 7 billion to 9 billion or more? Ruth DeFries is a professor of ecology and sustainable development at Columbia University. She uses satellite images to track how the world's demands for food and other resources are changing the planet, work that helped her win a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2007. She received her PhD from the Johns Hopkins University and is a prolific author of scholarly articles, as well as a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Her latest book is called, you heard me say ratchet before, her latest book is called The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of a Natural Crisis. It's available from Basic Books. Ruth DeFries, I want to welcome you to Midday to our show here at WYPR, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
Hey, I mentioned your connection to Johns Hopkins University, but you also had a connection to the University of Maryland, so before we get started, just a little bit more of your own background in terms of your education and research.
Yeah, so I did my PhD at Johns Hopkins. I got my degree in 1980, and it was an absolutely wonderful experience and a great place to think about these issues of how humans relate to the environment in a very interdisciplinary department, geography and environmental engineering, which was actually in the engineering school, a very forward-thinking department, and it remains that way today. Afterwards, after a few career moves, I found myself back at the University of Maryland in College Park, where there was quite a lot of wonderful colleagues to work with on using satellite imagery, as you explained, to look at the Earth and what changes we're bringing to the Earth.
And a particular interest of yours was food and food development and production.
Yes, I'm interested in food, agriculture, and also forests. I came to this topic through looking at tropical forests and deforestation, which quickly takes you into the realm of food, because the reason why people clear forests is mostly to grow food. So if we're going to understand the complexities of these relationships between forests and people and food, we have to look at this all as a system. So the food and the forests are just sort of two sides of the same coin.
You're described as an environmental geographer, or maybe you're self-described as an environmental geographer. And again, before we go on, I just want to know, is that accurate? And if so, exactly what does an environmental geographer do?
Well, I don't know. There could be many terms, I suppose. But a geography is a discipline that looks at the interaction between people and their environment. So that's a very apt description of the kind of work that I do and the kinds of issues that a lot of people are interested in. And there is the environmental side of it. There's all kinds of geography, cultural geography, historical geography, and so on. And this book, The Big Ratchet, I think, looks at many different sides of that. It's a historical story. There's some cultural elements. There's our natural systems of the planet that we depend on. So geography is really the way to bring all this together.
Well, let's talk about the title, Ruth, The Big Ratchet. Maybe you could explain to our listeners. I tried to there. I had some references to ratchet in my introduction. But it's a very interesting metaphor that you use here to describe different epochs in terms of human history. So why don't you take it from there? Explain to our listeners why you chose this device, so to speak. Pardon the pun.
Yeah. Well, it was a great introduction. You did a great job with that.
Thanks.
The Big Ratchet is the title for the book, and it refers to the last 50 years or so, where we've just had this enormous abundance increase in the amount of food that the world produces on a global scale. And it's astonishing that our species, 200,000 years, we've gone from being hunters and gatherers, like our closest ape relatives, to a species 7 billion plus that can produce such a massive amount of food and feed people that live mostly in cities. So that was my starting point. And then in the book, I'm working backwards historically to see how that really happened. And what I found was that we can't think about this increase in food production, this domination of the planet that we have today, as being a kind of a linear trend, that it's really more stepwise, more in ratchets, that we figured something out, some way to produce more food, manipulate nature, whether it's manipulating genetics, fertilizer, some kind of ingenious manipulation, which ratchets up the amount of food, ratchets up the population. As you said, ratchet a tool that moves in one direction. Inevitably, there's some kind of problem that falls out of that, whether it's pollution or shortage or disease or some kind of problem. That's the hatchet part. And then throughout history, we see the pattern that then we figure out something else. That's the pivot. So it's this continual cycle of problems and solutions and growth and crisis that I try to trace in the book, which culminates in this very big ratchet that we've seen in the last 50 years, where we've figured out how to produce so much food.
It's amazing what's happened in the last 50 years. Worldwide production of corn and rice nearly tripled. wheat more than doubled, and then we're past 7 billion people on this planet now.
It's astonishing. Whatever you might think, good or bad, about the repercussions, it's an astonishing technological feat, really, to produce so much food, which depends on our ingenuity, for sure, as a species, but also depends on this amazing planet that we live on, that we have all this recycling machinery, all of the ability to keep climate stable, all of these characteristics of our planet that so far we haven't found elsewhere in the universe. We may find that one day, but we have a really extraordinary planet and we are an extraordinary species.
Do you see the first real burst of population when we figure out how to cut down trees, cultivate ground, and plant seeds?
Yeah, so one of the very, very big pivots in the book is the domestication of agriculture starting around 10 or 12,000 years when people figured out how to select those plants which had desirable characteristics like large seeds to eat or easy to harvest or not too spiny or prickly so that they could be picked. And really, the same process that natural selection plays out in the natural world, the human hand selecting those desirable traits. And that led to increase in the ability to produce food with grains primarily, and this occurred in several different places around the world at different times and independently around the world. But the upshot of that was that it was then possible to have storable grain and a surplus, which then made it possible for people to live in cities or settlements and to perform different kinds of tasks. Not everyone had to be engaged in producing or preparing food. And then you have some people being artists, rulers, all kinds of tasks, which then really is the basis of civilization. So food for me, the way that we produce food is just fundamental to civilization. That's why I focused on food in the book.
Right, because civilization usually grows. What you're saying is that it comes down to balancing food supply and population is what you're looking at. We keep improving our lives till something goes terribly wrong, and then we have to figure out how to get through that, right?
Exactly. So with the domestication of agriculture, it increased the amount of food that could be produced, but there were problems that came along with that. That's the hatchet part of it. Diseases, crowd diseases like smallpox and tuberculosis from living closely with wildlife. A life expectancy decline, diets were starchier, a range of problems came along with that. So with every one of these ratchets and genius manipulations of nature, some kind of problem comes along with that. One of the big problems that came along with the domestication of agriculture was with soil fertility. So if we keep harvesting the crop, then we keep pulling the nutrients out of the soil, and how are we going to get those nutrients back? And that set civilization on a course to try to resolve that problem, which still goes on today.
Perhaps this is a minor note, but I remember reading about grain storage during this early period, and that the fact that we could store grain in villages and towns among people also meant that the rodents were coming, there were more rodents around, and then more disease.
Yes, rodents, disease, close proximity to livestock, where diseases emerged, measles and smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
These problems that came along with it.
And when you track the consumption of meat or the domestication of animals for livestock, for human consumption, no longer hunting but actually raising animals to be eaten, what do we see then, Ruth? We see more population growth?
Well, domestication of animals plays a large part in our narrative of how we became this dominant species on the planet in two ways. One is through the labor and the energy that they provide through pulling plows, mm-hmm. and the invention of the plow, and then having the animals use their labor instead of people doing all of the labor. So that was another very pivotal step in civilization. Along with that, being able to raise livestock for meat, which is only really possible because it's so energy intensive to produce meat if there is that abundance of energy.
So you have to have a system in place to produce meat, and maybe you have to be able to afford meat too, right?
Yes, well, so what we see in history is that times when there was abundant energy and people were wealthier, then they increased their consumption of animal products, meat and dairy and eggs and so on. And that's what we see today in the world today, that as people become better off, one of the very generalizable patterns throughout the world is that people increase their consumption of animal products. Of course, that plays out differently in different cultures, depending on their cultural preferences. But this pattern of increasing consumption of animal products is, whether that's milk or meat or eggs or whatever animal products, is we see that over and over again. And that's what we're seeing today throughout the world with the way that diets are changing.
I guess the question that we'll get to this hour as we speak with Ruth DeFries is can we keep it all going? The ratchet that turned in the last 50 years, we've had this burst of population growth. We have all this food on the planet, but all these big environmental problems that we're facing as well. Can we keep it all going? What happens next? So we'll get to those questions in this hour of the show with Ruth DeFries, professor of ecology and sustainable development at Columbia University, and author of this really interesting and provocative book, The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. A short break here on Midday. We'll be right back. Let me tell you how you can call in if you have a question for our guest. 410-662-8780, toll free 866-661-9309. Ruth DeFries pioneered the use of satellite images to track how the world's demands for food and other resources are changing the planet, work that helped her win a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2007. So far, she argues, humans have managed to muddle through, ratcheting up food production enough to keep ahead of dismal predictions that population would outstrip food supplies and result in massive starvation. But as any stockbroker or bookie will tell you, past performance doesn't necessarily guarantee the future. So that we'll get to that during this hour of our show with Ruth, whose book is called The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. So we described, or you described, the ratchet of about 10 or 12,000 years ago, you know, when man figured out how to plant crops. The hatchet, the example we cited in the beginning that you use in the book, is the Irish potato famine as an example of the hatchet. We ought to talk about that period, Ruth.
Yeah, so the potato is very interesting. The potato came from the New World after Columbus went to the New World, and there was such a massive exchange of plants and animals. The potato was one of those that came from the New World to Europe in the 1500s. Initially, people were scared of the potato. They thought it spread leprosy because it's bumpy and resembles a leprosy patient. Hmm. But through the course of the next few hundred years, people grew potatoes quite extensively because they are a very good crop. They can grow in poor soil, potatoes can be stored, and they're nutritious. And historians estimate that about a quarter of the growth in population in that period of the Middle Ages is attributable to the spread of the potato and the nutrition that people got from the potato. In Ireland, people were very, very dependent on the potato. And in the 1840s, calamity struck. So the other characteristic of potatoes is that they are genetic clones of one another, as you know from sort of science fair days. When you cut off a piece of a potato and put it in a in water, it'll sprout.
Right.
So the propagation of potatoes meant that there was not genetic diversity in the crops. So that made the situation ripe for the fungus that came along in the 1840s to decimate the potato crop. And the Irish being so dependent on the potato, the Irish peasants, was a tragedy. A million people died, as you said, before, a real tragedy. So here we have another example of a ratchet, the potato coming from the New World, ratcheting up the population in Europe. And then there was the problem, the hatchet that fell out of that, because the potatoes were genetic clones and grown so close together that the fungus could just spread and decimate the crop.
So humans, when we go through a crisis, we hope to learn something, right? We become better people. We supposedly advance through crises, or crises spawns progress. Would you say that's true in this case?
Yes. So one of the responses was so many people emigrating out of Ireland. And another response was to learn and to grow different varieties of potatoes, to plant potatoes further apart from each other so that the fungus could not spread, and also the transition of the Irish economy from being so reliant on potatoes for their diet to diversifying the economy. So when crisis strikes, it's a tragic event, the Irish potato famine. On one hand, many people died. On the other hand, it shows that the Irish were resilient. Population has not recovered until this day from the Irish potato famine, but the economy moves on.
It's worthy of note what you just said. 8.2 million people before the famine. And again, we're talking about the early to mid 19th century, and it's just over 6 million now.
Yes.
Yeah. And around that same period, we have the Industrial Revolution. And there were various doomsayers at the time who predicted that the world's food supply could never keep up with population, because with the Industrial Revolution, there would be, economies would grow, people would earn more money in different ways, and therefore, I guess, have larger families. So what happened there? I mean, there were a lot of people who thought that's what was going to happen. There was no way that we could produce enough food to sustain a growing population.
So the Reverend Thomas Malthus is the most famous of the doomsayers and predictors of calamity. And that was at the end of the 18th century, where he predicted that food famine was in store because population was increasing and increasing exponentially, and food production was only increasing linearly. So it was it was on a collision course. And from his vantage point, that made some sense. He was looking from his view of his window in time. And at that time, the Industrial Revolution had, cities were growing so massively. People were coming from the countryside. The countryside needed to supply all that food for the people in the cities. And there were a couple of years of drought that hit the crops hard. And he extrapolated from that short window in time to make this prediction. What I wanted to do in this book was to step away from that window in time and look at the broad sweep of history so that we don't make those sorts of extrapolations based on a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So what Malthus did not know, so yields were falling, there was drought, there were problems of soil fertility because of the recycling of waste from the cities to the countryside couldn't keep up with the needs for soil fertility. So all of this contributed to Malthus's dire predictions. What he didn't know was the next pivot that was in store, and he couldn't have known, and that was the fertilizer that came from South America in the form of bird poop. I don't know what word I can say on the air.
That was guano. Fine.
Okay, of guano.
Bat guano, right? A bird guano.
Bird guano, yeah. Boobies and cormorants and the birds that live off the rich waters of the western coast of South America. Mm-hmm. So the Incans had known for a long time that this guano was a very rich source of fertilizer, nitrogen, and phosphorus. A German explorer went to South America, Alexander Humboldt, in the early 19th century, and he brought back many specimens of bark and grass and rocks, all kinds of things. And one of the specimens that he brought back was this guano. So the European scientists figured out that this was a very rich source of fertilizer. Now, that set off the booming trade and lots of money to be made in this export of bird guano from South America to Europe and also to North America. And that kept the soils fertile for a couple of decades. The birds clearly can't keep up supplying so much guano to make up for all that was being mined out. So that also led to the hatchet of a shortage. The guano ran out. But at Malthus's time, when he was making those predictions, he could not have foreseen the guano. Now, when the guano was running out, there was Crookes, who was a British president of the British Association of Science, who again made the prediction of shortages, wheat shortages, famine, echoing Malthus. And he again was looking at extrapolating out from his short window of time. His predictions didn't come to pass because of the ability to synthesize nitrogen that developed in the early 20th century and keep soils fertile. So these projections that come from these looking at short extrapolations from short periods in time are really, I think, don't give us the full, broad, long lens picture that we need to look at this relationship between people and the planet. And that's what I was trying to do in the book.
Right. And what about the Industrial Revolution, Ruth? What about the mid-19th century when we get there and more people are moving to cities? They're finding different ways to work, to make a living, and families are growing?
Yeah. So the Industrial Revolution brought people were pumping out from the countryside into the cities. And the way that the soils were kept fertile at that time was by transporting the human waste, butcher waste from butcher shops, vegetable waste, all of these organic sources of fertilizer, carrying them back to the countryside. And these were known as the nightmen, who were the people who would collect all of this waste, including human waste, which was euphemistically termed night soil, and carrying that back to the countryside to sell to farmers. With the Industrial Revolution, with more and more people going to cities, that became less and less tractable. Mm-hmm. So here we are again in need. Population increasing, as you say, family size growing, leading to another search for another solution.
Right.
On the if I can continue on the issue of population size, what's mm-hmm. very interesting today is that we're out of this pattern of more food, more people. What we see around the world is that as people are better off, as they urbanize, especially as women have job opportunities and girls have schooling, family size decreases. So that's a shift from an agrarian kind of culture where a large family is needed to work the farm to an urban kind of lifestyle where I have two children. I don't know how many you have, but most people don't aspire to having large families like 10 or 12, the numbers that of large families in agrarian kinds of societies. So
right.
that's a very big shift in our demographics.
I understand. I can't help but think of, there's fewer of us per family maybe, but more food. There's all this abundance and more overweight people, at least in this country and in some other countries now.
Exactly. So this abundance has led to more problems. That's the pattern. That's the pattern that we see over and over. One of those problems is the obesity and overweight epidemic that we're seeing throughout the world. This is because increase in consumption of oils and fats and sugars. And this is not just a problem in this country or Europe, the industrialized world. This is throughout the world, throughout the developing world, we're seeing these increasing rates of obesity and overweight. At the same time, on the other side, we still have 800 and some million people who are chronically hungry, who don't get enough food, who cannot partake of this abundance because they can't afford it. They can't get access to this food. So the big ratchet has created this very lopsided sort of world.
Is the issue of overabundance the hatchet following the ratchet of the last 50 years?
I think so. I think the biggest hatchet following the big ratchet, and this is parlance, is this obesity, overweight, unhealthy food, ability to eat, to have access to so much inexpensive red meat, which is not healthy for us. That is certainly one of the hatchets. The other, as I said, is the inequitable distribution. And another third hatchet is the environmental impact of this abundance that we've created, the environmental impacts of industrial agriculture.
Well, that's the one I wanted to focus on for a little bit here with you, because as I'm you know, reading your book and thinking about this and looking at the latest reports from the UN Meteorological Society about greenhouse gas emissions, it just doesn't. There's something wrong. It just seems like there's just too many of us, too many demands on the planet. We're still stinking the place up, and there's more of us doing it. So that's, you know, that's what I look at, and I say this. It just seems like there's too many of us now. But who's to say? That's your point, isn't it? Who's to say what too many is?
Exactly. So there are a lot of us, and there will be more of us, somewhere between 9 and 10 billion in the coming century. Mm. The highest rate of growth of population is behind us. That was in the 1970s. So while population is continuing to increase in absolute numbers, the rate of growth is declining. And as we were talking about before, the more people urbanize and have job opportunities and have smaller families, the quicker population growth declines. So we will see more population. We're past the peak growth in the population rate, and how many people end up on the planet is a function of how these fertility rates, how many,
right,
family size, basically.
So did people smarten up, Ruth? I mean, I remember reading, is it the Paul Ehrlich book? What was the population?
The population bomb.
The population bomb. That was, I don't know, in the 60s or 70s, wasn't it? I mean, he and some others, you know, were predicting a lot of doom there about population growth. So, I mean, what happened? Are you saying we smartened up?
I'm not. Well, yes, the Ehrlich's predictions from the 1960s is another example in the book of these predictions. Mm-hmm. So again, from his window in time, it did look dire. There were impending food shortages in India, for example. But again, what he didn't foresee was this big ratchet, these technologies increasing food production in such a massive way.
We'll take another break here and come back and talk some more with Ruth DeFries, professor of ecology and sustainable development at Columbia University, studied and did some research here, significant research at the University of Maryland and at Johns Hopkins University. Her book is The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. We'll talk some more about the future when we get back on Midday. You're welcome to join us with a phone call and a question for our guest, 410-662-8780. The toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866 661-9309.
YPR.
Welcome back to Midday Friday. I hope you're enjoying this conversation with Ruth DeFries about her book, The Big, and her research, The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. You know, I guess that what I was getting at before, Ruth, it may just seem intuitive. It's not based on anything other than intuition that the Earth has a limit. There's a carrying capacity, so to speak, for the Earth, and it feels like we've reached it. I don't have anything more to give you than that, just intuition, yeah. You know.
This amazing planet that we live on, yes, it's cannot just supply resources infinitum.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've seen, this concept of carrying capacity is a really interesting one. It's an ecological concept for how many animals or individuals a given land can, given area of land can support. And it's a very intuitive, intriguing sort of concept. And it applies to people, to our species, but in a much more complicated, complex, and nuanced sort of way. Because we've shown over and over again that we keep increasing the carrying capacity through this technologies, through different ways of manipulating nature, through moving food around, through all of these ingenious ways we've figured out how to feed ourselves. So while the concept of carrying capacity is very useful when it comes to our species, I think we have to be careful about applying it too literally.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes you feel better or not.
Yeah, no, it does. No, actually, your whole book makes me feel a little bit better. I'm trying to explain why I feel the way I do about this. But I guess other men, other women at different times in our history have felt the same way.
Well, absolutely. And we see that in these examples of Malthus and Crookes and mm-hmm. Ehrlich and so forth. What I see today and what gives me some glimmer of hope is that we're seeing a lot more attention on these pivots, these next ways that we need to overcome the problems that we've created from the big ratchet. So if we think about this cycle that we've lived through, this amazing time of growth during the big ratchet, we now know what the hatchets are, at least some of the problems are that result from that. And now we're in that, following that pattern of figuring out what these pivots are. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's no guarantee for the future. As you said before, the history is one guide, but it's no guarantee. But we're starting to see a lot more attention. People are paying a lot more attention to their diets and what the impact of their diets is on the environment. There's a lot more attention on using fertilizer more efficiently so it doesn't run off into waterways, water more efficiently. And while what we see from the history is that these pivots take a lot of work, a lot of talent, a lot of ingenuity, but people have pivoted many times in the past. And again, that's no guarantee for the future, but it does point us in a direction of focusing on these mm-hmm. problems that we need to devise solutions.
And the alarmist does have a role in that.
The alarmist certainly have a role. They play a very important role. Rachel Carson is one discussed in the book and other alarmists. They certainly have a very important place in this debate, in identifying the problems, in sometimes extreme, but again, you need that important voice.
Let's take a phone call for our guest, Ruth DeFries, joining us this hour on Midday with her new book, The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis. Ruth, this is Laura in Baltimore. Laura has a question for you. Welcome to our show, Laura.
Hi. I'm a dietetic student, and I had to recently do research on biotechnology and specifically on wheat. And I found two opinion papers One was an op-ed published in the New York Times by Jason Lusk. He's a professor of agricultural economics at Oklahoma State. And the other was published in the Journal of Sustainable Agriculture. And they take opposing opinions on genetically modified foods, or specifically genetically modified wheat. And Mr. Lusk argues that we need genetically modified wheat because we're not going to keep up with production, especially facing a water shortage, whereas the sustainable agricultural article states that we already have enough food produced for the projected world population for 10 billion people. So I'm wondering what your opinion is, if we need to invest in genetically modified wheat. He specifically mentions the Monsanto Roundup Ready, that they're still in production on studying. They haven't released it yet. But then, again, the other opinion is that since we already produce enough food, we need to focus more on sustainable practices, and that it's politics that are keeping the distribution. So I'm wondering what your opinion is, if it falls somewhere in between, or if you have one side or the other that you think wins out.
Yeah, thanks, Laura, for that question. Manipulating genetics has been in our toolkit for millennia. That goes back to the first very big ratchet with domestication of agriculture. So manipulating genetics is really nothing new for our species. The new twist on it is that we can do it at a molecular level. So I don't oppose GMOs on the principle that they're manipulating genetics, but that's not to say that there aren't other issues with GMOs. I think they're not a silver bullet. They're certainly not a silver bullet. What we see from these stories over and over again, and that there really is no one single silver bullet that can solve all problems, and that we can say, okay, we're done figuring out how to produce food and tick that off. So I don't think GMOs are a silver bullet. But they could be useful in some of the challenges that we do face. We know we're going to have to produce more food. I certainly agree with the op-ed that you refer to about focusing on the distribution. There's more food in the world. There's enough food in the world to feed everyone. It's partly a distributional problem, so that's certainly an important dimension. We will need to produce more food. GMOs could conceivably be helpful in producing more drought-tolerant crops. There's a lot of potential also just in conventional plant breeding without going to the molecular side of things. Again, one of the issues today with GMOs is that they're in the hands of the private sector, whether they can focus on the crops that keep people healthy and fed for everyone to have a healthy diet in the world is another open question. So I'm not opposed to GMOs in principle. I think they could be one tool in the toolkit that we need to think about, and it's not a silver bullet.
Now, what about our response to the threat of greenhouse gases, the diminishing of the ozone layer on the planet? What would you say about that? Are enough hands on the ratchet this time with regard to that?
Well, agriculture is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, contributing to the climate change problem. Agriculture contributes about a quarter of all human sources of greenhouse gases, whether that's methane from livestock or nitrous oxide from fertilizer or carbon dioxide from clearing forests to expand agriculture. So the way we produce food is a big part of the story. Again, of course, we need alternative sources of energy, renewable sources of energy, but the way we produce food is a big part. And some of that has to do with our diets and our high consumption of animal products and red meat in particular, which requires a lot of energy to produce compared to more plant-based diets.
And so do you think we're reacting sufficiently? Because part of your argument is that, we make adjustments. We see problems and we deal with them. That's what humans are capable of doing.
Well, part of the issue with the climate change is that we see over and over again that we react to crises. And climate, while it is a crisis, we are seeing effects of climate change today. It's a sort of a slowly emerging crisis, so it's not the same sort of immediate crisis. Well, it is an immediate crisis, but the same sort of crisis that is presented to society where there needs to be an immediate solution. So that makes the climate problem a really difficult one, a really difficult political problem. I would say we're not doing enough, but hopefully we're going in that direction as people see more and more the impacts of climate change.
Ruth, I wanted to turn back to that word abundance for a moment because I'm curious about this. It just seems like human nature that we don't know how to manage abundance. Give us abundance and we go crazy. Isn't that sort of it's in human nature maybe not to to understand? Or can you point to a place in history where there was abundance and the humans on the planet at the time handled it well?
Well, I think this abundance that we're seeing on this global scale like we have now is something new for our species. And we are now an urban species. In 2007, more than half of us started to live in cities, and that's just increasing more and more. By the middle of the century, 70-80% of the world's population will be in cities. So that's a new way of being. So, and this abundance, this global scale abundance is a new way of being for our species, and it's a very short amount of time, and we haven't yet learned how to live with this new way of being.
Before you go today, I need to ask you about Anthropocene. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. This word's been around for, I don't know, 20 years now or so that I know of. But this is the new. This is the human epoch, right?
I know it's a mouthful.
I love it.
Anthropocene.
And we're in the Holocene now, right?
We are. So the Holocene is the geologic epoch starting about 10,000 years ago after the end of the last glaciation, where climate has been relatively stable.
Right.
So right now geologists are debating, I think, as we speak, about whether to declare the time period, the epic, geologic epic that we are now in, as the Anthropocene, the epic where humans are the dominant force. So this discussion is very interesting because
sure
from a geologist's point of view, what they're discussing is, well, okay, so we're living in this epic where humans are the dominant force of the planet. I think many people can agree on that. But when would you consider that it starts? So for geologists, they need some kind of marker in the rocks. So does the Anthropocene start with the Industrial Revolution, with the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere from burning coal? Does it start with the domestication of agriculture? You could go even further back than that and say, well, maybe it started when our ancestors long ago figured out how to control fire,
right,
which was a very important step.
I see. So there's lots of different points of debate there.
Yeah. So yeah, where does it start?
We've got about a minute left. Do you have an opinion about that yet?
My opinion, well, I think I would at least go back to the domestication of agriculture.
Okay.
That was just so enormous for our enormous step for our species.
A mere 10,000 years ago.
Yes.
Ruth, thank you so much. Enjoy this conversation. And congratulations on this book. Ruth DeFries, who did a lot of her studies and research here in Maryland, University of Maryland at Johns Hopkins University, now a professor at Columbia University. And her book is The Big Ratchet, How Humanity Thrives in the Face of Natural Crisis, a big survey of the relationship between the earth and humans. So, thank you so much. And food. Thank you so much, Ruth.
Thank you, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. And that book, by the way, is published by Basic Books. Hope you enjoyed our program today, our conversation with Ruth DeFries. Come back for another midday soon. We'll see you. Have a good time this afternoon, and we'll see you again for the next midday.